Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
Today we speak with Dwayne Bannon-Harrison from Murtamunja in Jervis Bay about the state of Indigenous food in Australia and about the ethical and respectful use of native ingredients in modern cuisine. All right, welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. Your host, Steph Postuma, here with my co-host, Simon Evans.
Hi.
And we're joined by Dwayne Bannon-Harrison here in Killala Bay.
Hey, lads, how are you?
Not bad, fantastic. Not bad. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, we usually start with an acknowledgement of country when we do a podcast, but we're here on your country. So why don't you tell us a bit about it and welcome us if you'd like.
Yeah, no worries. So, Yirrbanglai Yalaganmur Buau. So basically, in a rough translation, it's welcome to Wanniwandandian country. This place is very special to that of both the Dharug-speaking Wanniwandandian people, and just over the river, the Shoalhaven River, is the Gomia-speaking Darrawal people. So we acknowledge the communities of Jerinja, local Aboriginal community, and also Wreck Bay Aboriginal community, which are the two communities now in which they sit on either side of Burari, which means Bay of Plenty, and it's the waters just out here. And this place is significant to me in my through my lineage line, with my third generation great grandmother being born on the Shoalhaven River, on the banks of the Shoalhaven River here in Nowra. So, and her name was Ellen Demestri. Her mother is known as Sarah Lamb, but she was given she was straight off the tribal ways. So that's back going back to 1850. My old great grandmother was born on this river. All this country from the Shoalhaven River, out where this fellow works, not far, out there at the mouth, Shoalhaven Heads, which is the mouth of the Shoalhaven River, goes way around to a little place called Nimitabel. Nimitabel means divided water or many water. And that is about half an hour east, southeast, pretty much, of Cooma. So that northern, northwestern, western, and even into the southwestern boundary of what we know as the Yuin Nation, which has 13 different dialects. The Gomia and the Wadi Wadi people. So Gomia are the language group that encompass all around, obviously, the Berry area right up until from the north of the Shoalhaven River to the Crooked River, and then the Wadi Wadi people go all right into the escarpments of the Illawarra, which you guys have obviously come accustomed to and seen all that. But what binds the two language groups together, even though they're two different language groups, they spoke the same, spoke multilingual languages, and on average, our old people would speak anywhere between 6 to 8 different dialects in order to be able to trade, communicate, intermarriage, all those different things that would go on. So we're all bound together by what we know as Umbara, or Umbara, the black duck, and Umbara is the nation totem of the Yuin people. So even though technically the Darrawal people speak the Darrawal language, the Darrawal language, right up into the Georges River, the southern Darrawal people are very interconnected to the Yuin Nation. And that southern boundary goes down to a little place called Malakuta Janoa, over that invisible border, the Victoria-New South Wales border, which then goes into my great-grandfather's country, which is known as Gunai country, and that's where down on the Shoalhaven River, the Snowy River, the mouth of the Snowy River, way down in the Gippsland, a little place called Orbost. My old great-great-great-great-grandfather was a survivor of, unfortunately, what is known as the truth-telling of a massacre down there. And so that's a little bit of my history from both my paternal and maternal lines, and where we sit here on this country is the northern, one of the northern dialects of country, which I'm proud to call my home. It's a pretty good place, right?
Sure. Do you want to tell us a bit about the Indigenous community around where we are here, Jervis Bay and the Buttery National Park's a massive part of it, Wreck Bay, those sort of places?
Yep. So I've got a lot of lineage and family connection here, more so to the Wreck Bay community, but also have lineage and bloodline here to Gerringer. Both different communities, obviously, with fairly different histories in many respects. But the Shoalhaven community itself is actually one of the largest regional populations in New South Wales. It's quite a large population, encompasses many, many different groups that are probably native to Yuin country, but also from other different communities all around New South Wales and Australia for that matter. So, yeah, it's very diverse and it's ever growing. It's one of the fastest Aboriginal populations growing in New South Wales. So,
yeah, well, great. Okay, well, this podcast's called The Food Fight for a reason. We talk about food, and I guess what we were going to talk about today was how you use food more than just to feed people, because it does so much more. So why don't you tell us to start with a bit about your business and a bit about how you sort of came into the food world as well?
Yeah, well, I'll take you to a little place called Nimitabel, which encompasses my my grandmother's third generation grandmother. Her name was Anne McGrath, and she was a Nurku woman born in Delegate. And that's where I pull the language from. So Mirja, you got to say it through the nose like a black fella. Mirja Munja means hungry blackfish in my grandmother's language. So I thought that was really important. It's a language and a dialect of those languages I spoke to earlier. And I wanted to, number one, I want to bring that language to the forefront. So myself and the community of language learners that we've formulated here speak both the Durga language and also the Nurgu language, which are basically in simplified term are a freshwater and a saltwater language. So not only are they learning a second language, they're learning in a bilingual context, to learn two of those languages, because that's again the pattern of where them old people trod. So it's been a hell of a ride. I just spent a heap of energy today on the business. It'd be remiss of me not to acknowledge my beautiful wife who's in and around here and supplied us with some tucker. My daughter's in there now, in the back you can hear some movement going on at ripe old age of 10, cooking her special biscuits that she makes. So yeah, it's I think that speaks volumes, right?
For sure.
It's about family for us. It's about our kids embracing Mirja Munja and taking it into the future. So we started in 2018. It was just me through a connection of mine, which is a fellow that I'm pretty sure Simon knows, Clarence Lockie. He's a good brother of mine, and Clarence introduced us to Kylie Kwong. And Kylie just so happened to know my grandfather previous. So there was this sort of multi-prong connection. And she said, Dwayne, she rang me up and she said, Dwayne, I'd love you to come and do a food demo. We really want to showcase this. I've been with your grandfather, et cetera. And I could see that you're pretty handy. So let's go and do it. So through Kylie and that gracious opportunity from her, I sat around a little fire pit out there and barefoot, rogue as, don't tell the food authorities they're not watching this. I ended up doing some food demos, and as you do, I suppose for us it was about feeding as many as we could. That's culturally what we want to do. And even wife and I, still now, only this morning in our planning meeting, we're talking about portions, control. And as cooks, it's the ultimate one. You always want to make sure that people are are fed, you know.
Yeah.
So we still find it quite challenging. But anyway, I think I had about 30 portions of blackfish that we knocked out. And because we were a demo at that particular event, there was not, obviously we weren't making any money, you know, we had a little modest fee for being there. But anyway, the long and short of it is that we had a little plastic table. One of the nephews that was helping us on the night chucked out the hat, and then Clarence got on the mic as the MC and said, gold coin donation. We were getting redbacks and pineapples, you know, chucked in that, and actually done it all. I think we made about 400 bucks, you know, cash.
It's like food busking.
And, well, that is, lad, brothers, that's the truth. That's how it all started.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
And 3 years later, now we've got a bit of a beast, as you know, in the culinary world, learning some and have learned some pretty hard and fast lessons. Mm. Which we were talking on prior to recording today, but all great for growth. Mm. And I suppose the evolution and the growth and everything that we've done from doing, like I was saying to you guys before, I think we did our biggest serve, just under 500 portions in 4 hours at Carriage Works, you know, in 2019, and that's moving.
Yeah, unforgiving in Carriage Works as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, people there, they're queuing, they want the food.
Yeah, crazy. You know, I think we sold out the year before. So we came in that way and learnt, like I said, pretty hard, high volume, but, you know, met some pretty incredible people along the way. So, you know, where we sit now offering, you know, our pop-up restaurant dinners that you guys know of, that's where a lot of the magic happens for us, I suppose, in terms of the melting pot of what we bring essentially to the table. I think, you know, basically every night thus far since August last year has been, if not sold out, pretty close to it. So it's been pretty overwhelming and humbling.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose for us it's, you know, really focusing on the narrative of what we're doing and people understanding that. Seems to be a lot of intrigue in what we do. And you know what, we go okay, we can cook pretty handy as well, so that helps. And but again, it's sort of been that journey of how do we sort of, you know, focus on, like any business, I suppose, even more so importantly in current times. So we also offer a sort of home delivery menu offering of a lot of our product, which is, this is Irene behind me.
This
is Irene the smoker, and over there is Trevor, my two smokers. I'm not allowed in barbecues galore to purchase any more barbecues anymore.
It's kind of setup you got back there.
Yeah. So actually Trevor needs some attention, so we'll have to fix that one. So it's obviously the low and slow barbecuing brings fire and brings flavour, you know, using technology now, being a bit smarter in my... in the more sort of recent times on how to sort of, as you guys know, how to be in that sort of happy medium in terms of producing at a small but manageable quantity of commercial produce, and being smart around that, and essentially just trying to get use as many sort of vehicles and tools as we can and product offerings to give people the taste of what we call the indigenous twist. So careful not to call it bush tucker. I'm really, really focused on indigenous twist and how important that is to one of the key messages is, you know, what are people sort of, you know, when I'm doing this sort of stuff, what do I want to push out? Well, number one, I want, I want the natives put back into the Najangdar, you know, into the Mother Earth, the plants and the foods and the berries and everything that's supposed to grow here. The more we can get back in, the better. As you can see, you've got a beautiful paperbark tree just over the back there that we...
Pretty useful when you've got the smokers going.
Yeah, and it's got a small, nice small leaf and that, the different ranges of what we can use. And along with that is encouraging as many people as we can to, you know, buy authentically as possible and make sure that money or that economic, you know, growth hits the community. And to me, they're quite simple messages. They're quite powerful messages, but... I suppose the other thing to bring home the three is, you know, putting it out there in whatever forum I can when I get an opportunity or a microphone or whatever, is to also encourage that Indigenous communities and people, if they're not fully leading, they need to be at the front of this movement. Mm-hmm. I've done a few interviews now where, as you can see, there's a bit of a gap, and we're trying really hard to sort of I don't want to use a slogan term, close the gap, because it's a bit of a health initiative sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I suppose if we're looking at it from that point of view, you know, sitting down, nulagay dombili yelaga nulay, come and sit and eat good food and learn and let's talk. And it's a great soft, neutral way to break down barriers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So going back before sort of talking to Kylie and doing the Carriage Works gigs, what was your was food something you thought you would go into, or was it merely just a you know, home cooking and an interest, and you know, how was the transition between going from that to suddenly going into business and doing pop-ups?
100%.
Was that event did that spark sort of an idea where you're like, well, there's both a business in this and a platform for me to spread a message, and correct. Went from there?
Correct. It was that. I suppose the love of cooking, I'll go to that first, is that my Irish Gaelic grandfather, who came over in the 70s and brought my mum over and her two younger brothers and sister in the 70s. Mum was 9 when she came over. And she was actually born in Blackpool in England, but we're very proud Gaelic and Scotsman. I suppose the connection that I have through food definitely comes through my mum's dad, my grandfather, who was a galley cook and went around the world 13 times. He went on as a 13-year-old boy and had many experiences and ended up working.
A galley kitchen does not seem like the place for a 13-year-old boy.
You know, and he just sort of got through there and navigated it and started to obviously grow. And he spent some time on the ocean liners and then obviously had started to have a family and then moved over. And they actually moved over to Coniston. And he got a job at the steelworks. So that's how they came across. So, but you know, my memories and early memories of him, basically, he's the reason why I fell in love with cooking. And so it's always been there. And the love. And you know, Amelia, my wife, she's a very handy cook, probably better than me in many respects. You know, so you know, it. I suppose in terms of your point, that's sort of, it did spruik us. We did a lot of in-house catering for the cultural awareness initiative that I still currently and continue to lead. That's sort of the umbrella of everything, and that goes deeper into the teachings of my dad's dad, who obviously was on the Indigenous line of how I connect to country. That's another big long story. But so Mutitjimunja is a byproduct, and then you pretty much sort of honed in on it there, you know, Steph, when you said. Is this? I suppose the conversation we had out of that first opportunity that I spoke about at Carriage Works, that was part of what it was. It was like we could probably, you know, do something with this. And I suppose, yeah, as they say, the rest is history. It doesn't make millions of dollars. You know, I'm waiting for the big restaurant to come through yet. But as you guys know, it's a grind, and no one's making money either. You know, right now, if anyone's making money, let us know.
apply within.
But yeah, that's right. But I suppose the point being is that everyone's got to eat, right? So I think if we keep sticking solid and staying together, we'll be okay. But so that's pretty much where, you know, where we sit and why we do what we do. But many, many facets. I suppose people that come and experience what we do are genuinely fulfilled, you know, on a lot of levels, mind, body and spirit.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's why, one of the reasons I love cooking and food is it's more than, I mean, there's so many layers to it. It's more than just the technical side, more than just being in the kitchen. It's the experience you can give people in the way it can bring people together, and you can portray messages and tell stories. And obviously that's a massive part of what you do.
Mm, definitely. And I think that, you know, everything from what sort of reminds me of that particular point and speaks to it is, you know, from my perspective anyway, is the sauce, you know, that I do. It's simple, but process driven in terms of adding sarsaparilla, which is a vine leaf that's really good for our immunity boost, you know, and you know, bringing that with the vitamin C high whack in the rainforest or Davidson plum.
Mm.
Just that little moment of educating people, what and what my old people have taught me, and especially my grandfather, is the foods are our medicines and the medicines are our foods. Seasonality helped us understand what we took into our body and what we didn't. And I think if we start to really look at, like we are in a lot of different areas, but especially around Indigenous food, there's that same sort of holistic way of understanding it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the other sides of native Australian ingredients is there's a lot of chefs involved and interested in it, but then there's also the health benefits.
Yeah.
And something like Kakadu plums, obviously with some of the highest levels of vitamin C ever. And I think it's Christian Hampson's story about how the timing of Kakadu plum harvest would coincide with winter coming, and people obviously eat and boost their immune system with vitamin C, and that would you know, help see them through winter. And that kind of connection and that kind of seasonality of not just being let's buy seasonally, but like let's work with it, because it's actually kind of works with your immune system, with your body, with your diet and your nutrition, and that kind of whole round approach I find pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's it basically just solidifies the narrative, and you know, as my good friend Bruce Pascoe would say in Dark Emu, one of the big messages there, you know, is, you know, looking at how diverse and how now our old people, don't tell the French and the Moroccans, but are the first bread makers.
Yeah, yeah.
And carbon dates prove that. You know, I suppose to validate that in scientific research, I suppose in modern society helps, but our old people have been saying it for millennia.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's probably one of the bigger messages from me to people that come and experience what we do, or from, you know, speaking or whatever I'm doing. It's about us celebrating that. It's celebrating the oldest living, continuing civilization and society in the world by many, many thousands of years. You know, ancient Egypt comes second, I think, at 7.5 to 9, and we're in the, you know, hundreds of thousands of years now. And I know that everybody's starting to wake up and smell the daisies on that. And that's what I really admire most about us, you know, giving people, you know, an idea, a taste, an experience about what's actually here. And Uncle Noel Butler is a beautiful man and one of my teachers, and he always speaks a lot about, you know, there's only 6,000 or so of proteins, foods, you know, nuts and berries here to we'll go and explore edibles, and so good luck, you know, and getting to know them all. And, you know, again, I sort of need to bring in my next you know, special person in our journey, and it's probably no secret that we so happen to have a great relationship, and I call him my Jijang now, my brother in Benchuri. And, you know, to have number one in the country, you know, obviously seeing the journey of Attica, seeing what he's just now done with Attica Summer Camp,
and,
you know, we were due to catch up, you know, in last week, but I knew that he was putting in, as we all know, some the big hours and getting it all done. And but I suppose to the point, you know, Ben and I have had many conversations here on this couch too, you know, yarning about, you know, trying to, I suppose, you know, keeping Indigenous cuisine to the forefront. And I suppose, you know, the level of knowledge base, I think there's a lot of eagerness and curiosity around it. And I've sat with a few chefs in Sydney, head chefs, and, you know, pretty show great vulnerability, you know, in saying, Dwayne, I know bugger all, you know,
especially from chefs who are very ego driven.
Well, that's and this guy was dead set fresh and French, you know, culinary trained, like sort of, you know, schools and done it all. And you know, he was pretty good. He was pretty good in terms of, and a few others as well. Yeah, so I think obviously it goes without saying that this is a massive. I wrote a document today. It's you know, it's such a fast and rapidly growing movement, I suppose, now. And what I am loving, and what you guys probably have seen as well, is we look in our Indigenous business and entrepreneurial demographic, and even in the growth in the last 2 years has been quite phenomenal. Indigenous business, especially, is probably one of the fastest growing business spaces that there is in the country. So, and a lot of that's based on, you know, a lot of wholesale and, you know, oils and, you know, getting in and getting things happening and demonstrating our culture. So,
I think those two things go hand in hand, is that you need to have a viable business growing native ingredients or producing plants. You need to have chefs buying them. So obviously that kind of works hand in hand. And as you see more chefs start to get interested in these ingredients, you see more producers, and that makes it easier for everyone to access them, make sure it, you know, becomes more viable as a business. I mean, like 8 years ago when I moved here, I would sort of ask people what is sort of Australian food, and never really get a satisfactory answer. And it wasn't like until 3 or 4 years working here that I think it was lemon myrtle was one of the first things I saw.
Yeah.
And someone was like, oh, that's native. And I'm like, oh, so there is... like native ingredients, yeah. Just no idea, and it didn't seem like anyone was really using them, or it wasn't in any of the media that I could find. I found that shocking that there was this, and then obviously if I learned and worked some of these ingredients, it's an absolute rabbit hole, and it's just shocking to me why chefs haven't been using these amazing ingredients, or white chefs anyway, using these amazing ingredients for years. And I guess one of the things that kind of made me fascinated with it was because this information just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, what can I learn? What can I find out?
In a moment, I reckon we should move on to a bit about supply and that. But I guess firstly, a question, working with all these different chefs, and you know, you would have been right in the middle of watching these ingredients come into prominence in finer dining venues and things like that. Do you see, is there any issues around these ingredients being used in a way where chefs are using them because they're trendy and because they work, and people go, oh, it's got bunya nut. And I feel as if chefs have a responsibility to educate themselves on the significance of these products, that, you know, in more depth than just it's something you put on a plate. Is there an issue or a possibility that, like, wisdom and culture and stuff doesn't get transmitted in the way that it should as these ingredients grow in popularity and just get chucked on plates, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. No, it's one of my... it's one of my pot shots, I suppose, and it's sort of been a bit softer, but you've put it, you know, pretty straight and bold, which is great. And I think, you know, it's like you said, it's a big difference making a white cream sauce and adding a lemon myrtle leaf and like you said, hashtag native food.
Yes,
it is a trend. There, we've got to be real and cut to the chase. That it is a trend. I suppose what way we look at that trend in a positive way, like I've sort of been alluding to, is jumping on the back of. And I think there was a research done, and I think this has grown now, but I did a interview last year for, it was either Good Food or Gourmet Traveller, one of the two. And I was asked, you know, a question similar to what you put. And it was at one point only 1% of the industry was Aboriginal owned and led. I know that you guys know enough to know that they're still only minor.
Yeah, it's 5% now.
So it's grown a little bit. It's not much. But yeah, it's tiny. Yeah, 100%. So I think, we've got to look at that little bit of spike, and that's something. Got to celebrate the wins every now and again. But yeah, getting back to I suppose what we're really talking about is the ethics around it. I suppose to put it in another way, from our realm is, you know, there's only certain types of fish I can have, you know, like I can't have mullet, you know, unless there's certain people around and certain season, you know, because culturally I can't have that. And it's one of my totems. And, I suppose from another way is that I very seldom, and I don't use barramundi because it's a long way from up there. So I basically am trying to ethically show people even the different types of kangaroo. If it's a red female, I know that from certain knowledge holders that have given me that, that's okay for someone out of country to eat that. So then I've just sort of gone right into the micro there on that for you guys, and really honing in on the cultural significance of us, you know, as a first people and what we have to go to. But I suppose embedding that practice into the industry from a culinary point of view, but also from a consumer point of view of understanding that a little more. And so yeah, I'm all about, yeah, sure, you know, Amelia does a fantastic job in sourcing what she can, and sometimes we have to pay through the nose. Yeah. You know, not so much from the actual wholesaler, but you know, for courier or whatever circumstance, or to make sure that, again, that message that I said before about making sure that we're integral in what we, you know, try and put in Aboriginal owned and Indigenous led first. And sometimes I'll be really honest, sometimes it, from a business point of view, if someone was appraising that, then what they're like, why don't you go to one of the bigger mainstream suppliers, you know, we can get probably faster product turnaround, you know, this, that, the
more,
other.
More product, more bulk.
Yeah, you know, so we've got to be conscious of that, you know. And again, to your point, Steph, is I think the real importance for me in the message that I can give, and I know there will be some chefs listening, is, you know, do the work. Make this a priority and do the work, is my message. And I don't know, I don't mind what that is. If that's going to, you know, if you're on the South Coast or in Sydney, going, spending time with certain elders, or, you know, whatever, you know, it's not easy. Let's face it. It's not accessible, you know, everywhere, but there are places you can go and start.
And
I think the effort that goes into sourcing local, or, you know, all these different ways of, I suppose, at the end of the day, that's what makes your brand or your style, or, you know, what you put on the plate unique. I suppose, yeah, it goes to making it more foundational, which probably will take more work and, you know, research and consultation. And, you know, we might be working on a menu item for 4 years before we get it to the plate, right? And I suppose that's not all that different from what goes on, you know, in some of these restaurants, you know, from time to time, you know, trying to perfect it, or, you know, getting it where it needs to be in a shape. So I suppose, yeah, to your point, it's about not thinking it as an add-on or an afterthought. You know, it's actually, okay, so if we're going to make a commitment to utilizing native ingredients, okay, number one, how do we embed that as good practice and, you know, ethics in our culture of what we're doing and where we're shooting to? Again, I go back to Attica and Ben as a shining example of that, you know, of how he's done that. And he tells me the story of a few people, you know, chuckling at him back in 2002 when he came over as this rogue from New Zealand, Pacquiao, coming over and trying to, you know, change the face. And similar to yourself, Simon, he basically says it in a bit more of a cruder way, but, you know, where the fudge is all the native, you know, where is it, and who are the people, and what's going on? And it's pretty much the questions that he and I, and hearing his story as well. So, and I think, you know, whether it's, you know, a Maningrida green ant, or, you know, going to either where my grandfather, grandmother country, Yorta Yorta, Wemba Wemba country, where there's the beautiful big, you know, witchetty grubs, or, you know, whatever that is, or whatever you're sourcing, or wherever you're shooting to. This ethical practice of engaging, at least in some capacity, with the local communities will, you know, go a long way. And I think, as we spoke to earlier, the research and the studies, or, you know, appraising where we're at, is important, you know. And there's a lot of the pie to go around for everybody. And if we do it right, there's going to be great prosperity from everybody involved. You know?
It's something that chefs do anyway. When they find a new supplier, they'll, you know, chefs love going to little farms and getting their Instagram pictures of them picking little baby beets and stuff. And they'll talk to the supplier and be like, you know, what's in season? You'll see sort of the same chefs just buying, you know, whatever, Kakadu plum powder or lemon myrtle powder from whoever, without talking to that person, for one, finding out how they're getting those ingredients, and the other thing then finding out about them, the seasonality, what best to use them, and all these things people would do across their other sourcing of ingredients, more apprehensive to. And you know, we've always tried to work with you know, Aboriginal owned companies who can give us some of that information and put some of these products in context and how they might be used, and that's always helped. Like we saw some stuff from Maningrida, and got these little blueby yams, and I spent fucking hours trying to cook them and trying to get them right. And in the end, I just had to be like, can you help? Like, I have no idea. I've tried like tried all my techniques here. Like, how do you cook them? And they're just like, you'll have to come up and see.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, I'll do that one day. Because, yeah, it's just, I mean, just passing that knowledge on is what's key to, like I said, to sort of kind of ground these ingredients and you know, show where they're from and the significance of them.
Mm. Yeah, it's a similar story that Ben is along the same lines with our elder Uncle Noel on Bimblers, you know, how he just cooked the shit out of them.
Yeah,
and he's like, they got to be overcooked, but they were right on.
Yeah, you know?
You know, some of these different, I don't know, I suppose, again, it speaks to the different techniques. Like I seen one of the, watching a cooking show the other night, the gentleman's name, he was on one of those cooking shows, I can't remember now. Yeah, but
there's too many of them.
Yeah, there's a few there. But anyway, he done a Japanese technique on what we say mutton or abalone, and it was really good, like the way he did it. And it was just totally, so there's just a bit of a flip around on something that we cook as second nature. Go straight out the front here, we can get a feed abs and chuck them on the rocks and cook them quite quickly and swiftly, where this technique was 3 hours and looked quite interesting. So I suppose the moral to that is everybody's got something to learn from each other. And I suppose once the indigenous technique and narrative is out and more prominent, and we're learning from each other, like, we, you know, this is a big space, and to us it should, and it can, and it will change Australian cuisine, so to speak. And my question, I suppose, for you guys to ponder on is, you know, how, what's it going to be touted as? Is it going to be Indigenous cuisine? Is it going to be the Australian cuisine? Is it the First Peoples cuisine? Whatever it is, it's a cuisine in its own right. So whether or not the Australian cuisine can embed that, which it's slowly starting to, you know, connect with. And I know, just to know, I don't know Neil Perry personally, but I've seen the work that he does also with the National Indigenous Culinary Institute as well, and they do great work as well. So there's great pockets of work happening, you know, and some of these chefs are leading that in that space, which is great. But also the importance of, again, knowing, like you said before, the source, you know, are there any cultural considerations? So what you spoke to earlier about, you know, the Maningrida, you know, produce, whatever it is, there's always a story to it. There's always a technique. And so those that haven't, I strongly recommend a great book called Wandu, which is a good gentleman, brother named Damien Coulthard and Rebecca have done a great job in packaging together a phenomenal book, which we've got, and we even have to go to that to off the learning and the work of our brothers and sisters, you know, which is great, you know, of the work and the dedication that they've put into it. So to again in consolidating the movement and learning from each other and bringing each other forward and up is a really important message. So I think there's no doubt that food produce and you know, in Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander, in the First People space is really, really, you know, important.
Yeah, I think I heard you say in a previous podcast I listened to, it's kind of, it's not up to one person, or it's not one person's job to change this space. It's about cumulative growth.
Yeah.
And even with those people who may be using Indigenous ingredients in a bit of a tokenistic way, there is some good from there, because hopefully they're still buying and they're showing, and it's all growth within. I think obviously you need you know, people who like yourself and like Ben and Kylie, who are kind of holding it all together and leading the way of, like, it's good you're using these ingredients, let's show you how you can do it better and in more sensitive ways. And that seems to be slowly happening with people, you know, coming more at the forefront of this kind of space.
Do you I mean, you left us with a really important question and something that I want to think about going forward. You know, what form is Indigenous or Australian or Indigenous Australian or First Nations cuisine going to take, and what's it going to be touted as looking forward? Is this something you think about, and that you, like, how would you like to see it? And you're in a unique position with the company you keep and the work that you do to be able to shape it. Do you sit down with people like Ben and Kylie and think in yourself, like, how can we shape what this cuisine looks like? Because it's growing in popularity, and I think that for a very long time Australia was looking for an Australian cuisine, and we hadn't found it, and now people are starting to realize that we might, you know, have something that brings this nation together in a way that that can be called Australian or can be called whatever yeah. it gets called.
Yeah. That in itself is a good metaphor for the Australian history narrative anyway. It's it's like all of a sudden, oh, bang, we've realized that there's an ancient knowledge base and food that we, you know, that we would never have thought of utilizing. But then again, there's a lot of people here locally. Like, we just had a gentleman give us a whole container of fresh lily pillies. You know, there's kangaroo apples, you know. Mm. People are actually going, oh, this has been growing in my garden forever.
Yeah.
We don't know what to do with it. We'll give it to you. So Mills are like, yeah, scoop, you know.
Here's
so
the freebies.
We'll take it. Yeah, we'll take it. And that only happened the other day. And, yeah, beautiful gentleman who did that. So I think just in that, to what you were speaking about, what is, where do I see it? Well, you know, in the bold, ever the opportunist, you know, vision of myself towards how I see it is, I want in say 10 years time to, you know, either hear conversations, or, you know, even just observe, you know, someone coming to a town or a place and actually saying, okay, instead of where's the local Indian or Chinese or, you know, pub grub, where's the local Indigenous place where we can go and source,
mm-hmm.
you know, some taco, where's the local community, what are they offering here? That's a bold play, it's a big one, but that's something to again bring our cuisine and the narrative, you know, it's to the forefront. And it's a big challenge, but I think it...
I mean, the fact that it's a bold proposition says a lot.
Because,
I mean, if you went to any other country, if you went to Vietnam or into India,
yeah.
you'd go there and you'd be like, where's the traditional food? Where's the locals eat?
Yeah.
Like, and that's not unusual in any other culture.
Mm.
But here, that's a bold proposition.
Yeah.
And that speaks a lot about where we are right now.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And I think, again, sort of speaking to what I said earlier, this is a great opportunity, and will continue to be. I already know of another good sister girl of mine out in the Central West who started a very similar sort of movement, you know, to us in terms of the food journey at nights, you know, and doing her own work. And, you know, the more that it becomes a mapping, I suppose, and more familiar people get with it, then it'll you know, continue to sort of grow and grow. But again, everybody's got a responsibility and an opportunity to, you know, jump on and make this something, you know, that it should have been a long time ago. So I suppose the upshot of all of that is, if there's more demand for native produce, there's more natives going into the ground that's supposed to grow here, you know, and I suppose the rest can sort of flow on from there. But yeah, you know, country, heal the land, heal the people is another saying that I'm pretty familiar with as well. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity because there is a kind of a deficit of native ingredients. The demand is outweighing the growth. So, I mean, it's a good time and some great opportunity for people to fill that space, and hopefully there's people doing it the right way. But yeah, it's I mean, it seems like a exciting time. So it feels like we're on the sort of precipice of something. Now, I've only been here for 8 years, and I've heard that this precipice has been here before, where people thought we were going to make the next step, and it hasn't quite happened. But yeah, hopefully with everyone pushing towards a sort of similar goal, like, well, we'll get somewhere.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm just going to ask this, but it's just a really tough question. How do we, with what we're talking about, how do we avoid white people, you know, just grabbing as much of the marketplace as they can because it's unregulated, you know, not like you have to have a certain certification in order to grow whatever it might be and sell it wholesale. How do we avoid that market getting saturated by white-owned businesses and white people, and how do we activate the Indigenous community to be as much of a part of it as possible?
Yeah, it is. It's a question and it gets spoken about a lot, but there's already some things happening in that space. And it is around, you know, looking at licensing and intellectual property, especially around some of these real key sort of niche places. And look, it's one of those things, right? It's the dance. It's I'm a keep cup monster, and you know, always looking at my, you know, whether I'm going to go and have this or what's going to happen with that reusable cup. But then I realised that, you know, it's probably takes about equivalent to 250 of those recyclable cups to make my keep cup. You know, not, you know what I mean? Like, that's just something I've heard in more recent times of how we've got to think about this dance of what we're doing. But there's always that fine line, you know, between the two. And I think that question is one of those. It's like, well, you know, if there were more non-Indigenous people, you know, jumping on that bandwagon, sure, okay, financially we miss out, you know, on a few different levels. And it is, it should be managed and it should be regulated. But I suppose on the upshot of that is, again, it goes back to what I was saying before, it becomes more prominent and hopefully country gets healthier. So we have to sort of look at that as well and go, yeah, all right, we can see that as the upshot. But definitely, to your point, it's sort of what I was banging on earlier about, you know, it's to me, it's up to the people that are in these positions. Obviously, chefs can help, you know, source and do it ethically, just as we do with sustainability practice. So I suppose it's a, if you wanted to put it as a cultural responsibility practice or whatever you want to label it as, it becomes part of your value system, you know, and how you do that. So maybe you're right. The likelihood, the privilege and the prosperity of non-Indigenous Australia have a definite advantage in that realm. So I suppose, yeah, watch your space, as they say. But yeah, I do see the pros and cons of all of that. But I think it's a little bit similar to, you know, people's informed choice or, you know, how they're being educated. So I think we can fishnet a lot of people along the way, you know, as an upshot, whereas they're not blatantly oblivious or, you know, not malicely ignorant to it, but they're actually more aware. So we're probably getting some wins as well.
Yeah, I guess
so.
if you educate the demand, the supply will follow from that. You can vote with your wallet of where you shop. So same, you know, when we talk about shopping local or shopping at farmers' markets, it's just the same thing, that there can't be a supply if there's no demand for that person selling that product.
Yeah. So we have a to help with that, and it's not specifically earmarked for food or bush tucker. I know there's a bush tucker alliance, so they've been set up. I'm not overly familiar with that, but the other thing that I know we have is Supply Nation, which is a database of recognised Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander businesses. So for the listeners out there, if you're looking for that, it's always a good symbol to look for as a brand and entity should support, because you know it's going into the Aboriginal business economy.
Their website has a list of Aboriginal businesses as well.
Yeah,
which I found some interesting. I found a good chemical company recently, Nude Cosmetics might be, they sell sanitizer and surface clean and all these things with scented with native ingredients. So it's found them, like, right, we'll need to get them in the restaurant then.
100%. And it was even a petroleum company now. These are the sorts of things, again, to the point of, you know, Aboriginal entrepreneurship, and I see culinary as entrepreneurial in its own right anyway. So many offshoots of it, and I think that's definitely another thing that as we grow and as the industry grows, we definitely can. And you know what, like, some pretty, as you guys know, some pretty educated people out there these days. So it's not easy, not so easy to pull the wool over many people's eyes. They really want to see authenticity, and we've got to have faith in that too. I believe in my work that I run New South Wales health training for now for 7 years. It's a mandated training. It's 4 hours of me going, I'm getting the body language and the energy off this mob, and I've got to try to give them as many, and I see that as a challenge also, as yeah. many key messages and get them to sort of see it from our perspective along the way, you know. So using that as an example, it, there's many different forums that I come into and I'm talking to people about these things. And yeah, I see it. I see people switch even in that space in the 4-hour turnaround of being arms folded, probably not even making eye contact, to actually moving in and engaging and going, okay, I've got some food for thought now. I'm going to go and read Dark Emu, even though I'm a bit still a bit skeptical.
Yeah.
To me, that's a good thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we're planting seeds.
Yeah.
And I say that in what I do is I'm here to do many things, but I'm also here to challenge your mindset, good, bad, or in between. Mm. And as we all know from a wellness or a moving forward journey of living a good life, it's you need growth. You need the opportunity to grow and be better.
So, yeah. Cool.
Maybe a question that I have, and it might be a very ignorant question, but that's okay.
I've heard some, mate.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's some doozies. We need a whole other podcast let you all
know. Yeah, well, there you go. Do a little short one, a snappy one with like ignorant questions with Dwayne.
You gave me some thoughts.
But has this... Has this upswell of interest and usage of native ingredients facilitated like a reconnection for the Indigenous community, and if so, where and how? Like, how do we see this?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we as a society or community, and even, you know, I'm always having conversations with my grandfather. So again, it'd be remiss of me not to mention him as my teacher. And he's actually 85 this month. He says he's 21 because he was born on the 29th of February. So if you did it, he's 84 last year, but if you do the math, he was 21 and he's shooting to 105, he tells me. So he's still got 20 odd years to be here. In what we sort of, hone in on and what we speak about, it's about giving it away, you know, to keep it. And, you know, the knowledge is there to be shared, but it's also there for people to earn the right as well. You know, so I suppose, you know, we get a lot of people, and I often have to what I was having a bit of a pot shot at earlier, I get a collage of emails, even in the last 30 days, of people wanting... demanding, putting it on their terms, how they'd like their tailored experience, but it needs to fit their itinerary.
Mm.
And it's sort of like, you know, you wish I had one, a big emoji to just go like that, you know, and thanks, but no thanks. But, you know, you can't get angry about that. There's an intent that, you know, whether it be genuine or whether it's just interest or, you know, but it's always on their terms, not always, but people that come into our processes, I believe they've done, like I said before, they've done the work because they're actually, like what I say, buy into the process, not just monetary, but value, in a value way as well, of going, you know what, I'm giving you, and from a time and energy point of view. Are you willing to give us your time and energy? It's a bit like your point before, come up and we'll show you how to do it. And that's that lesson, see, and then come up and show us how eager you are, and we'll reward you with the goods. We'll give you the goods, but we need to see your face again. And that's, you know, if you really look at that common stitching of the narrative, that's a big message from Aboriginal people.
Mm.
Now, our voice and collective voice hasn't been completely heard. You know, if we look at everything, and I won't bore you with all the cultural awareness, when it's turning into a cultural awareness session in the most part, but, you know, if we look at our 230-year inconsistent history, from January 1, 1901, we're still not recognising the current constitution of this country. 73% of Indigenous Australia in 2017 said no, thank you. We don't want to be recognised because of the lie of terra nullius and the indoctrinated Western system that now, you know, controls us. And that's where we still are, guys. You know, whether we swallow that or whether we don't, that is the facts. You know, that's where we are. And I suppose to your point, though, in coming in on it to me, it's... you know, for our mob to get the confidence, and I mean the opportunity more than a sort of a swanky narrative. It's more like, okay, now I can do a catch and cook, something that my grandparents or my uncle has shown me. And some of these, and one thing that comes to mind for me is my good friends out at Wimpatja country, which is far western New South Wales, Broken Hill, Wilcannia, out at the Murrawindji National Park. And I've got a photo, and I posted on our Murrawindji Instagram last year, I think it was. And it was a picture of an ancient bush oven, which is an emu oven. And, like, you know, to see that, and what I mean by that is how casual the guides were. Oh, yeah, that's where we used to cook emu over there. And I'm like, hang on a minute, what? Yeah. You know, how did this work? You know, yeah. And to see even them old ancient rocks that are thousands of years old, they're still there, the remnants, yeah. You know, and you could see it needs a bit of work. But, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, how much, what else is there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
What else would you want to see than see that old man emu or old lady emu be caught properly and put in that oven with the feathers on and actually seeing that celebrated and ceremonial around that and to actually be a part of that whole process? Mm. And I use that example because I was like, hey, hang on a minute, what's this? Can we do it? Yeah, we can do it. We haven't done it for a while, but, you know, just really casual as you like.
Yeah.
This is amazing. People would pay top dollar and you could do something, you know. So anyway, there's many, many stories just like that where what I'm trying to get to the bottom line of is that our mob either just sort of undersell that a lot. You know, we need to upsell ourselves more. Yeah, yeah. And that's a hard thing because of the transgenerational trauma and our history, and we've been told you can't, you know, speak up. And that even is evident with my dad's, you know, siblings and my family, you know. So
even getting dismissed, like in Dark Emu talks about how some of these amazing structures like the eel traps things like that were completely dismissed when you actually look at them without maybe the sort of the rose-tinted glasses of colonial racism and current racism.
Yeah.
It's mind-bogglingly fascinating that like when I first read about the eel traps and then the burnt out trees using the smokers, that was just insane to me because that was so far from anything I'd read and ever learned.
Yeah.
And I can't see how anyone could not find that absolutely fascinating and want to know everything about that. Because that was just an amazing thing where I'm like way before European civilizations and other people were doing these things, they already had like a system of smoking and preserving, which is something that all food cultures have as well, and just predates it by so many years. Like that was just a wild read.
Joking with someone the other day, you know, they asked me how do we document this, like just some of the stories of where we could go with the Indigenous food journey needs its own Netflix series, you know. It really does. Needs time dedicated to it, and I suppose, you know, seeing, I think it was the Fyodor one, the most recent one, and
Chef's Table,
and you know, there was a little story and a little catch, if you haven't seen the episode or anyone that's seen it, with a good brother named Juan Walker. So the Walker family have been doing mud crabbing up in Gugu-Yalanji country up at Cape, you know, for a long time, and you know, there was a little snippet of that, and the lady from Tourism Australia said, oh, that was, you know, fantastic that happened, but I had to bite my tongue because I'm like, yeah, if you dedicate at least another 10, 15 minutes to Juan and what he actually could have said, you know. But again, you know, that's sort of, it's that dance again, you know. It's sort of like, you know, we've really got to sort of dedicate again everything that I've said, time, energy, value on what it is. So therefore we go, okay, yeah, well, number one, what can we, and let's put it this way, you know, what's going to be, you know, economically positive for me, or you know, what's going to generate good interest, and how am I going to, you know, let's put it, how are we going to benefit from this as a community or a family or an organization? And again, one of those really funny sort of you know, emails or phone calls and all this mob, you know, wanting and wanting to put us up on this pedestal. It's quite, you know, mind-boggling to see that. It's again, I go back to that question that I've got out for everybody to think about. The question that I always ask myself is this person genuinely interested? Well, from the, you know, the two paragraph email they've sent me of trying to justify they've got a connection with some community or some sort of connection, yeah, that's great, but then try and turn it around and have it on their terms. So for me, I suppose, as a person that really, it probably sounds that I'm being quite ungrateful in some ways, but I do see through the bullshit, you know, and I like to call it out, but not to attack anyone, but just to point it out to say, hey, you know, maybe you should lean this way, and maybe we're going to be all be better for it. If you know, you mightn't like what I've got to say right now, but yeah, wife and I have had it, especially over the last 6 months. You know, a lot of opportunities. Netflix actually got touted as one, and you know, these opportunities that are going to be great for us. And I suppose that as a leader in my community, it's a lonely place. It's a mega lonely place. You know, the detriments and the not so good things and the isolation you feel as an Indigenous person or person of colour, you know, that can sit around and basically match pound for pound with anybody that sits with me, you know, from an intellect or sitting down and yarning. I hold that dear, but in a way of trying to hold the space pretty much, you know, and really trying to help everybody along. And yeah, that's something that I do see a lot of.
It seems like there's a lot of pressure on people of color and First Nation people to teach everyone.
Yeah.
And that's quite an unfair grab of time from people, especially talking about history and culture and as past traumas you're bringing up. And it's you know, perfectly. Some people just wouldn't want to do that, and rightly so and fairly so. Mm. So I think it's definitely something for people to realize that. If you're asking for time, that is someone's time. That's someone's, you know, time is money.
Yeah.
And to be respectful and patient with the way they want to teach you or the time frame they have and all these things, because it does seem like it's and you see it a lot. It's like, if you want to know more, ask. And it's like, but ask the people who want to teach.
Mm.
So I think it's something everyone needs to be sort of respectful of when asking for someone's time and knowledge.
Yeah.
Mm.
It goes back to that, you know, valuing what that person is giving you, and there's no measurables a lot of the time, so it's hard. It's apples to apples sometimes, you know, for some people. And you know, again, it goes back to genuine, you know, I don't know, wrap a number around it, but some are genuine, some aren't. Sometimes I can pick them, you know, straight away, even if their request isn't red hot. I can always pick the genuine people, like we do in every day business or what we're doing, you know. And sometimes I'll work on an opportunity with that person and try to sort of bring them, you know, into this space because I see the value in it. And I think, you know, that's part of our growth too, you know, and that's why we're really concentrating hard on, you know, education and workshops for our own people, you know, to enhance them and let them grow in business. So there's nothing more exciting for me. And on Wednesday, we've got a workshop. It's a tourism workshop, and in another cap, I'm the chair of the New South Wales Aboriginal Tourism Operators Council. Obviously, hospitality and food is involved in that. And we've got a workshop of community that'll be in there, you know, developing their business idea or their tourism initiative. And that excites me, I suppose, in the proof's in the concept that I, up until about 2 years ago, I was doing it all voluntary because I cared for it, you know, and I seen the opportunity, and lucky enough now to get a bit of a modest fee for service here and there when we do that type of work. But the most important thing about that is that, you know, the transfer of knowledge, we speak about that a lot about this in a well-being space, that transfer of knowledge and how important that is and how powerful that can be. You know, the more transfer of knowledge spaces like we're holding right now, the better for us, you know. And I think the point that you made earlier, that all comes from learning and you know, looking past the unveiling of, you know, I don't use this term very loosely, I use it quite straight and purposeful, is the white privilege, you know, and what that is and what that means. It basically means through the lens of what a ancestral lineage has done in a patriarchal, toxic, dominated society, that we've got to do what I say a lot of people do, a lot of unlearning. Got to do a lot of unlearning, and sometimes we can learn so much from zipping our lip and just listening, you know, even if that is for 2 days with an elder on country or whatever. And that the most recent sort of deal, I sort of really wrestled with this opportunity, and it was a Tourism Australia sort of campaign, and a young lady, she was quite, you know, she was a good lady, she was a journo, and she, you know, had her intent, and I got a journo here as well, but she had her intent. She had a series of questions that she wanted to ask. She was so used to, because she was doing an article for, it was, you know, for Vogue magazine. It was a pretty big, high end sort of thing. And after about, oh, must have been about, out of the 40-hour experience, after about 12 hours, she stopped asking questions. And that just took me cleverly but respectfully showing her that just hold that space, hold that. You know, she'd say something and I'd say, just hold that for a minute. And, you know, and that was a learning. And that was nice that she actually debriefed and checked out on that and actually stated, yeah, I learnt this morning that I wasn't going to get far. And you know, I held my ground. And that's what's just in that of actually, you know, partaking in the process. That's what I speak a lot about. And learning in the process is just as much as what you're there for, you know, or what you take home. So... yeah, and these systems of teaching, don't forget, are the oldest by many, many thousands of years. So we can all learn, because even you guys, as you know, not Anglo-Saxon, you know, you look back at that culture, where did it go? We'd go to the Vikings and we go to Henry VIII, where I always say it went wrong, you know. but once upon a time, your old people lived the exact same way as the old people here, you know, still do sometimes, you know. Yeah. It's about that universal oneness as well. And I believe in that. I'm an advocate for that, but it certainly does not dispel the injustices that have happened to my people as well. So it's, again, we're talking about that dance again of understanding, you know, and the more, again, conversations like this happen and the more people that listen in, you know, to actually see where we're coming from. I'm a byproduct of the two worlds and I've got a massive advantage. I'm also a concoction of the most, and I say this boldly, but I say it a lot, the most marginalized group of people in this country, being a mixed descent Indigenous person, too white to be black, where do we sit? Well, I've got a great opportunity to do that. And if you speak to many mixed descent Aboriginal people, they'll give you a very similar story, you know, of, you know, discrimination even as, you know, from own communities and families. And you know, that's not anyone's fault, or that's part of the transgenerational trauma and what has happened and what's transpired. But you know, it is. There's a lot of realities to the work that we do and what we, why we do what we do. But at the end of the day, it's a bit like that black cockatoo that sung out and told us a bit of rain was coming. You know, we're always listening for those messages. And at the end of the day, what I've been taught, it'll basically show itself, you know.
I reckon we'll get close to wrapping up. I might give you the opportunity now, Dwayne. Like, is there anything else you wanted to talk about or make people aware of? Anything you wanted to teach us while we're here?
Yeah, probably banged on a lot, eh? Probably the longest podcast I've done yet. But I think, you know, just to recap on where we went, we covered a lot of things. And I really liked, you know, the angle you guys came in on, and let's just sit down and have a yarn. Yeah, okay, we can talk about a bit about food and that surface stuff, but again, it sort of goes back to, you know, the nale or the nule, the food being the portal to a deeper conversation, right? And so, like we say, which I believe is a philosophy in food altogether, is, you know, wars have been solved over food sitting down some food, you know. Not saying we're totally at war here, but, you know, that what it does is helps conflict resolution and it helps misunderstanding.
It's a fairly kind of user-friendly way of introducing people to these stories. Like, everyone eats, remember that earlier.
Correct.
Everyone sits down, everyone eats food, and food can bring stories. And that I think, I mean, with me, definitely my first interest with native ingredients was, these are cool. I've never seen other people use these. I don't see many other chefs using them. Let's get some. And that led me to snowball and to learn and to read and to sort of seek out people who I could learn from. So, I mean, I think that's what food is amazing for.
100%. And yeah, I think, you know, the ethical practice and the approach of engaging with community, again, there's no one size fits all. It's a very diverse and tangible and breathing concept. Again, we pointed that into similar sort of, you know, methodology as we do in our general sort of work, business or wherever we are. And yeah, I think again that understanding that there's always a, you know, a person that knows more, you know, and we can sit down and with the right intent, the right time frame, and buying in through value of whatever that value is, exchange of money or exchange of time and energy or in kind. You know, you'd be surprised how many, you know, people are a bit thrown when I say, well, what do you do? Well, let's do a trade. You know, that's our old way. Let's in kind share. I'll give you some of this if you know, you help me and reciprocate that. But yeah, look, there's a whole heap of, you know, touch points that we've hit today. But I think those are those main ones. And you know, again, we're very honoured and very privileged to be where we are. Again, I'll be really honest, as you know, Simon, and what we touched on earlier, it's a tough grind, and we're in a shape where we've got to put some energy behind, you know, what we love. And again, we know it's not going to have us retiring having cocktails by the pool anytime soon.
But, yeah.
You know, it's a great vehicle, like we spoke to before, a great vehicle and a great opportunity to make change. So I see Mirichimunja as much as, hopefully what can be a successful business that we can hand and pass on as an opportunity to make that change and a real, you know, vehicle to drive it. Another thing that we're just working on, I'll just give it sort of an intent to the people that are listening. I just started, working on the consultation arm of the work, and something I've probably, again, talking about underselling. I haven't upsold that a lot. So we did a pretty interesting session with Restaurant Hubert last year.
Awesome.
Good group of people.
Yeah.
Swill House is the larger chain. Anton and the crew, that they were really good in terms of getting me in there, and going underground in the middle of Sydney was interesting, and educating people and cultural awareness. But you know, they bought into the process, those guys, and they got a big awakening. I just touched base with them only a couple of days ago, and they're still processing, which doesn't surprise me. The what, you know, they sort of know the what and the why. They're just trying to think about how, I suppose. And I suppose, yeah, that's sort of where we're going to go into a lot more, is that I'd love to, sit down and help non-Indigenous, but also our own community. There's that whole part of it, of keeping that sort of movement going, but more importantly, educating food people that there's a bit of work there. So we're flipping our direction around a little bit. We spoke to before, we don't want to be there, even though we've technically got a food truck, we're technically offering a food trailer. That's our kitchen, our mobile kitchen. It's very handy and it's good, but we want to be more than just the food vendor guys that pop up, and because we can offer that, you know, a lot more. You never close the door on those opportunities, because that could help you promote and brand, as we all know, a lot of the why people do go to festivals, really, not really to make the main sort of revenue. But yeah, so anyway, we've got a few different things that we're working on, and pretty excited for what the year has to have for us. But Amelia and I keep talking about, it's like, well, we now, one big advantage of this, we've got a great brand, a great product. We know what we've got to do. It's just a matter of, again, going to that how and what we want to put our energy and our focus on. And so I'm really excited about that part of the work. And I've started venturing in, and it's stuff that I do pretty second nature, really. So I'm just putting that, that arm of the work and concentrating more energy on that. So, but I still, I still chuck on the apron and have a bit of a cook too.
Yeah,
so,
nice.
You know, you can't not
gotta,
do
gotta
that.
Got to ground yourself in the kitchen, 100%, actually. Get the shit kicked out of you in a couple hundred covers.
Well, we've got to pop up this week, so no doubt I'll have the apron on in a day or two anyway. Yeah. So running around like a mad hatter. But, you know, in saying that, like we said off camera, before the buzz, it's, you got to love it. You got to love the buzz.
And then
we do. We love the buzz. So whatever. You know, just trying to manage it and keep it where it needs to be. But yeah, there's nothing like the buzz of doing a service. So,
I think if you can, you kind of interweave your ethics and your culture, and a message into the food you're making, that's all the better to help you love it during the times when it's quite unlovable.
That's him. That's him. Definitely.
All right, Dwayne. Mate, thanks so much for giving us your time and chatting to us. And I really hope that this is the first conversation of many, because there's always plenty more to talk about. But this will develop. Like, you'll see this use of ingredients, the way that people interact with it, the work that you're doing, the way that you communicate, develop over time. And it'd be interesting to, like, we're all sort of waiting with bated breath in a way to see how this plays out. So yeah, hopefully the first of many. Yeah.
Thanks for having me on, lads.
Thanks,
mate. Pleasure.
Cheers. Thanks.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.